Hello and welcome to episode 117 of the Crate and Crowbar, a PC gaming podcast. I'm Marsh Davis. I'm joined this evening by Tom Francis.
Hello.
And Christopher Thurston.
Hi.
And a general sense of unease and disappointment at two particular things that have occurred today, Chris.
The first is the removal of the Tiny Little Gold Stars from Twitter and their replacement. I shit you not. By the time you listen to this, you'll not be tired of hearing about this at all. With little red hearts, favs becoming likes, but likes being represented by the symbol for love, confusing the emotional transaction of Twitter entirely.
Yeah, it's like the gold star was sort of non-committal, and the heart is very committal, but also like is not that committal, and favourite really is. Like is a strong word. This is my favourite, but I wouldn't say I like it.
I think favourite was so meaningless that it just became fav, and fav was almost its own thing. It was just sort of like general credit. It was like, was what that expressed. Mm-hmm. This is fine.
Is this game news, though?
No. But it's, well, it affects the scoring system of something I play every day for approval. So to that extent, yes. Mm-hmm. And I'm cross about it. And I think they'll change it back because the response, as far as I can tell, has been entirely, entirely negative, which is something there isn't a button for on Twitter. So.
Did you fav or not fav, or heart even, the new teaser trailer for the trailer of the World of Warcraft movie?
So by the time this comes out, this actual trailer will exist and maybe people's opinions will be more enlightened than us living in the past watching 15-second trailers for trailers. I thought it was. I think I would have given it an old fav, but not a new fav.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's your favourite, but you don't like it.
Yeah, exactly. It's my favourite thing.
So are you passive-aggressively giving that fav out?
Well, no, it's partly bookmarking for later and also going, well, they've definitely made a very expensive-looking film about Warcraft. And in some ways, it looks quite a lot like Warcraft. There's a shot of some fields that's clearly that bit west field, Westland.
That one in the west, yeah.
Fieldland.
I remember that.
The one that's near Stormwind. And there are like harvest golems and stuff, and like, you know, they're really committed. They're really doing it. They're not just making a film called that. That's actually something else. I like Warcraft. I grew up reading those books, and I used to like the Warcraft universe. I'm still not sure why that's happening, or why and how it's Duncan Jones happens to be making it, who's a director I like a huge amount, and that's the thing that gives me faith in it. Like I'd have written it off by now as like a movie we'll watch while drunk because it'll be on Netflix in about a year and a half. Mm. Had it anybody else been the director of it?
Yeah.
There's no reason that should make for a good film, really. And I don't really know what it is about Duncan Jones' particular talents that lend themselves to massive shoulder padded men and orcs
Blizzard's
whacking each other.
Cinematics have always been like just the most absurd fight scenes. Like everything's just a massive sprawling fight scene with people energetically smashing each other, and I wonder how much they want this to be that.
Do you know if it's are they using their own in-house people to do the graphics?
No, it looks pretty different, doesn't it?
I don't think it's Blizzard, if that's what you mean.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, they do have a huge basically CG making movie team there. They're presumably underemployed for most months of the year. So,
I think we used to say back when those CG sequences looked 100 times better than the in-game graphics, we used to say like, oh, if only they'd make a whole movie like this. But these days, I don't say that anymore because games look pretty good.
And also, I mean, I doubt that's the case because, I mean, this is still like an echelon above what those cutscenes manage, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's not aware enough of the process to say one way or another, but I would assume that you need to get extra specialist knowledge to do something at this scale with real actors and stuff and the rest of it. Maybe. I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. You've seen the Chris Roberts production.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's real actors and stuff.
And that's literally the same studio that made Age of Ultron and all of the new Star Wars films.
Right, yeah.
So that's kind of the point, right? They didn't do that in-house. They went to Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, but whether it's any good, just it's still such a strange combination of talent and subject matter that it sends my brain haywire.
Mind you, Peter Jackson, who was a favorite director of mine for his movie Brain Dead, which is about like drinking zombie vomit and blowing up sheep in New Zealand, was then attached to Lord of the Rings.
Maybe this is
that was a surprising move.
Lord of the Rings.
Yes, the exact moment where all of his talent evaporated. So let's hope the same doesn't happen for Duncan Jones.
Yeah, that's kind of why I thought of it as like sort of a very creative and funny person making something that's really pretty devoid of humor and personality. Although, you know, it has qualities I like about it, but it's pretty barren personality wise.
It's interesting because the main thing the trailer shows off, because the dialogue in it is just the character design, the costume design. And the orcs just look like high-res Warcraft orcs. Like they haven't done much to make it, you know, humanize them, I guess, or make them look more like the actors that are playing them.
I don't know. I think they're quite humanoid. Well, but they're certainly less caricaturish than any of the.
Yeah, but they've gone on like what I'm saying is that the humans and the orcs are sort of met somewhere in the middle because like the things the humans are wearing are totally ridiculous. Like they haven't toned down Warcraft armor really. They've just made a vague attempt at making it look like a human could actually wear stuff with shoulder pads that big and so on. There's I pointed this out on Twitter today, but there's a shot which is like a king holding a sword in the air and everyone cheering or whatever, and the side is a wizard who's clearly meant to be like a sort of a court wizard kind of figure. But the entire scene, it's very, very CG heavy and a little bit flat looking. And he looks ludicrous. Yeah, it might well be.
What's his actual name?
Kale.
Kale.
Close.
Sorry, there's a...
His catchphrase is a Shelenore, something like that.
Would you like to ride a donkey? Look, a little monkey.
Do you remember all the orc barks when you used to order orcs around in like Warcraft 2? Like the Logdar and Zugzug.
Yeah. But yeah, like and he looks, even in the context of a massively oversaturated CG castle scene with guys in ridiculous silver and blue armor in front of two giant golden lion banners, the man in the wizard costume looks silly. Can I say?
Yeah. It's going to be a hard sell, I think.
The thing is, I'll actually be at BlizzCon when this podcast goes out, watching the trailer for the first time that it's shown in the world live, at which point I'll either be really into it because I'll be surrounded by like 20,000 people who are really, really into it, or for some reason there'll be like a technical error. This podcast will get broadcast through the speakers and I'll be like hung, drawn and quartered.
One of the techies there is an avid listener.
Yeah, just like sort of shaking with sobbing. I'm sorry, that guy, if this is happening. Also, stop what you're currently doing.
You've also been to a conference this last week, haven't you, Tom?
Yes. I went to Indiecade in Los Angeles about a week ago-ish.
How was it?
It was cool. It's a thing that happens in a series of tents in Culver City, which makes it quite different to like GDC, which is a massive expo hall, plus a whole bunch of like hundreds of talks. This is much more lo-fi, and the selections, they have like a main selection stuff, which they display in a fire station. And then they also had a bunch of other selections this year, but the stuff that gets selected tends to be a bit more offbeat than things in the IGF, and they are open to non-digital games. So sometimes board games or card games are in. Although actually I say board games, but I haven't seen any board games I've ever heard of in Indiecade. The one, like 2 years ago, I was there at gunpoint and we were exhibiting next to a game that was played with like three dice and a coin. And right. That was it. So they seem to be like more homebrew. I think if a board game is currently in manufacture, then it probably would not be selected for Indiecade. But that means it's quite nice because it means most of the stuff there I haven't heard of. Well, yeah, probably most. And there's a bunch of stuff that I have. Like the most mainstream thing in there was Kerbal Space Program, which is pretty mainstream. And while I was there, like a couple of kids of like 10 and 12 were wandering around looking at all the games, and I heard them say, "Oh my God, Kerbal Space Program's here!" and rush over to it. But there was a whole bunch of quite interesting stuff. There's one that called Tribal and Error. I feel like it could have been called Tribe and Error. Doesn't that sound more like
That's
Trial and
good.
Error?
Hmm.
But you are a robot sent back in time to caveman times, and all you can do is record what they say and play it back to them. And so every time like you go up to a caveman, they will like grunt something at you. And in game, there'll be a speech bubble with like a symbol in it. And that symbol is like one of the caveman words, but there's no way of knowing what it means except by context. So the first one you meet is shivering and keeps saying this word at you. So you, when they say the word at you, it appears in your inventory. It's kind of like you've picked it up now.
I see.
And so you can play it back. But also you can label it. So you click the label and like rotating cold.
Right.
And then there's like one bashing a pile of rocks with a stick and he's saying two words. And so I labeled one of them stick and one of them rocks. And that turned out to be wrong. One of them, the first word I think meant hit and the other one meant rocks.
Right.
And so there's one throwing a rock against a wall and the one who's cold is quite near a pile of logs that looks like a campfire that hasn't been lit. And it's a really nice concept because there's no someone standing next to me was asking them, oh, so how many languages are you going to like have this game released in? And they said, well, all of them, because there is no language in the game. Like the only language in it is what you write down in those labels. So whatever language you speak, you write that language. And so all of the game is just caveman language, which is all made up. And it's a really nice idea. I found it too hard in its current incarnation because there's no, like the puzzle progression that you would get if this was being made by Valve or something would be you learn that cold thing. That works really well because you're pretty sure it means cold. And then immediately there would be a puzzle that in which saying cold solves the puzzle. And I don't know what that puzzle will be, but the idea is you gain a piece of information, you understand what it means, you apply it in some way, and then they escalate the puzzle so that it's, it has one more element or you have to repeat it in a more complicated way. Or they add what, like one twist at a time. But in this case, you learn cold, then you find the guy hitting a bunch of rocks with a stick and you learn two words. And like I say, I got it wrong because there's no way to know whether he meant stick or hit. And then you find the rock, the guy throwing rocks at rocks, and you might figure out one of those is throw, but none of this knowledge is tested for ages. And there are lots of puzzles in this area that can be solved. But until you solve one, none of this knowledge is kind of validated. You just have all these theories about what these words might mean. And because you have so many, it's really easy to get in a total mess. Like, think you're saying something really simple to a caveman and he just keeps shrugging at you. There's one where, like, a guy's crying at a picture of what looks like his family and he's just saying one word. And, like, is that people? Is it family? Is it sad? Is it drawing? So I tried saying the word to other cavemen and they would, like, shrug and then do a kind of like fist swinging darn it gesture. And I'm like, what? And apparently that was them trying to hug me. And so that was meant to communicate that the word means sad. And when you say sad to someone, they think you mean you're sad. And so they hug you. But the animation just didn't communicate that at all. So they got a lot of work ahead of them to make that stuff so intuitive that you can just understand it by looking at it.
Yeah, so what's this language is this game in? Oh, it's in the Omni language of gestures that everybody understands completely.
But I thought it was a cool idea, and it's also super cute. Your character is like, because you're just a audio recording thing, your eyes are tape spools, and you just float around. Then I saw a game called Myriad. Has anyone seen that? It's a...
Oh, yeah.
You played it?
No, but it's a great-sounding game.
Yeah.
It's made by Erland Grefsrud, right?
Right.
Slacked us on the Twitters.
It looks completely fucking nuts.
Yeah, I've seen lots of videos of it. I have still no idea how it works.
I played it.
Like, it's like a shmup, right? In some weird way.
Yeah. I played it, and I still had no idea how it worked. But it's a series of... It's 2D... Very simple color palette, and it's you're kind of orbiting these, like, I guess, planetoid things, just discs, and you can kind of jump away from them and you can jump from one to the next. And each one you land on changes what weapon you're using. So I found that one of them, when I landed on it, switched my standard shotgunny thing to a kind of really powerful beam where when I'm firing at it, I get knocked back miles. And that would go through all enemies and kill them all. And so I would just fire that so far, so hard that I would shoot off into space to the point where I couldn't see anything except blackness. And then when I let myself land, all of the enemies were dead. And that was cool.
I wasn't watching the videos. I wasn't even aware there were enemies in it. I thought it was more like, you know, remember that game where you you set off detonations and your initial detonation has to detonate other things and then it causes a chain reaction. I thought it was something like that.
Every extend?
Yeah, yeah, every extend extra, isn't it? But is it not? Is it more like a conventional shmup with...
There is an element of that. So you are... Stuff? What you're trying to do is each circle you're on, the number of concentric rings it has is telling you how many times, how many explosions it has to be hit by. And what you're trying to do is, like, coax enough enemies into the right areas that you can kill them in the right spots. And each time they die, they leave a circle behind. And that circle is kind of like an explosive barrel. And so if you leave lots of circles next to each other and then you shoot the circles, then they all detonate at once and they cause a chain reaction. And then they complete the core, which is the thing with the concentric rings that needs to be hit by a certain number of explosions. And the idea is, like, if there's four cores and one of them requires seven explosions and one of them requires two and one of them requires five, and then certain enemy types are leaving behind exploding barrel-type circles, but other ones are leaving behind barriers that need to be destroyed. Other ones leave just circles that you have to just stand in to blow them up. And you're supposed to arrange all those elements in a really elaborate way so that you can do it all in one go, basically. One detonation will do it all, and that would be the high score. But it's the thing that I was fascinated by when I was looking at other people playing it was... This seems like a game where, like, the least important visual elements have massive visual impact. Like, everything, every effect that goes through anything inverts the color of what it touches. So each object will have, like, two colors. This thing is either red or blue. And every time a beam goes through it, every bit that's currently red goes to blue, and every bit that's currently blue goes to red. And if another beam is crossing that, then that inverts it again. And sometimes you get literally, like, you know, 50 beams all crossing the same thing, and it becomes like a checkerboard. Yeah, of those two colors. But because each thing has its own theme of colors, they all they're all incredibly visually noisy, but it's possible to distinguish them, because if it's red or blue, it's part of that thing, and if it's green or pink, it's part of that thing, and so on. And then you can also drag the circles around with right mouse, which causes, like, the whole world to kind of distend, and it feels like you're going through, like, a black and white tunnel and everything distorts around you. It's completely mad. It's quite fun to play, though.
That sounds amazing. Well, I really want to play it, mostly because of the soundtrack, which is by Flatland, which sounds great. I think it's one of my favourite bits of chiptune music of the last few years. If it's chiptune, I'm not sure it really counts as chiptune. Certainly, you know, electronic music.
I also played a game called Ellie the Messy Elephant.
Right.
This is up my street.
Where you wear an Oculus Rift that is made up to look like an elephant's head. And it has attached to it a move controller trunk. Well, it looks like it's just a sort of like cotton trunk, and you have to hold that, and that's your controller. And in game, it's swinging your trunk around as you press buttons on. Well, like, the motion of it swings the trunk around, and then the buttons on it cause your trunk to, like, clench around things. And you're at a tea party, and you have to, like, pour yourself a cup of tea with a teapot and lift the cup to your mouth. Except that, for reasons unknown, this feels like maybe a structural problem they didn't think through until the last minute. Your mouth is on the top of your head. In order to drink the tea, you have to sort of pour it on top of your head.
Huh.
And there's a note just saying, unlike real elephants, Ellie's mouth is on the top of her head. Which was, like, something they sort of noticed at the 11th hour. Like, oh, isn't the elephant's mouth below the trunk?
What? God, I'm having this weird flashback now. Is it Fantasia or something, where an elephant, like a cartoon elephant, lifts a cup of tea above its head in order to pour it down into its mouth? Was this a dream I've had? But I have a real memory of, like, seeing that animation, so maybe that was an oblique reference.
From Dumbo or something, maybe.
It might have been Dumbo, actually. That would make more sense.
Yeah, I don't think there are any elephants in Fantasia.
No, mate, aren't there? Aren't there dancing elephants? Or is that also Dumbo?
No.
Or also hallucination.
Yeah.
You could be right. Any other games?
Moving swiftly on from that game. I played Thumper a bit.
Oh, yeah. another amazingly soundtracked game.
Yeah. So it's they call it a Rhythm Hell game.
Oh, I know that one. That's not Bambi.
And you are like a chrome beetle going along a track. It looks almost like Audio Surf at a glance, only a million times shinier and smoother. And as you kind of coast around this track and the music plays... crazy psychedelic visuals swirl behind you and underneath, and it's all very, very sinister and oppressive and angry. And when the music kind of kicks in, there'll be these kind of pulses on the track, and you have to hit the button at the time that you go past the pulses, and then there'll be these little corners that are kind of glowing, and you have to hold the correct direction for the corner and press the button at the same time in order to survive those. If you don't do that, you just die. And those pulses that you pick up, at first they don't seem to do anything. It's just like they just tell you to press the button at the time you go over them. But then you learn there's kind of a knack to kind of grabbing them by pressing the button and holding it long enough to kind of charge them up and then releasing them. And then you realize, like, the kind of weird void that you're traveling into is actually a creature, and you're attacking it by doing that. And you're basically sort of firing fireballs at it. And so the more of those you get right, the quicker you deal with the boss. And it's incredibly simple as a game. The music kind of makes it work a lot better than it otherwise would, because it's very kind of sparse at times, and then will suddenly kick in with, like, really angry bass. And that will be perfectly timed to the course and to the challenges. And the thing that was interesting about it was that it's gorgeous to look at and kind of like just quite pleasant to play despite being a rhythm hell game, until they teach you that corner thing. And the corner thing is really kind of visually impactful because you're coming along at incredible speeds. You hit this corner, and as long as you're pressing the right series of buttons, then you just jerk around the corner. You don't slow down at all. You just kind of wrench around it, and it feels really kind of jarring. And when it's just one corner on a long track, that feels... it's not that overwhelming or anything. And then you do that, like, probably the first, like, six or seven corners are just really spaced out. You have loads of time to prepare for them, loads of time afterwards to get back into the swing of whatever else you're doing. And then suddenly they just throw, like, four corners at you in a row. Like, you do one corner, and then it's immediately just one in your face. And four times in a row, just as the music is, like, picking up pace. And I might have died the first time, and then the second time I did it. And I think I died on the second corner the first time, because I just wasn't ready for any kind of challenge at all out of the first one. And then once I figured out there was a challenge coming, I survived the second one, and then immediately realized, oh shit, there's a third one, and oh shit, there's a fourth one, and got those right, but only on by the skin of my teeth. And I realized, like, my pulse rate had, like, doubled. I was kind of, like, sweating. I was like, holy shit, that's the most engaged I've ever been with anything that simple in that short a space of time.
Huh.
And just through pacing, mostly, like, and the visuals and the music and stuff, but everything working together. It's a really interesting case study as a game designer, because you always wonder if your game has enough complexity and depth, and will it be long-term interesting, will people get everything out of it? And Thumper's a good demonstration of, like, well, if you ever do run out of depth, you can just, like, polish it to fuck. Just make it look and feel amazing and sound amazing, and that'll count for a lot.
Hmm. When are any of these games coming out?
No idea.
Okay.
It's not a question I asked anybody, I don't think. I also played... I played that Memories of a Broken Dimension game.
Oh, that? Is that...
Crazy glitch one.
Yeah.
It or won
Monochrome, right?
Yeah. Monochrome, it's like the ultimate glitch game. Like, it has not just the sort of familiar glitchy artifacts of, you know, certain things being displayed wrongly, but it also has these really interesting shaders where the things you just saw persist on your vision a little bit, and then they get kind of eaten away by a kind of wind that's blowing through and pulling particles off everything. Mm. It's really fascinating. Playing it, I couldn't tell you anything about what it's like as a game because it was just utterly baffling. But I think it's meant to be. And
you're not just floating through this void of abstract horror shapes. No, there is like a level geometry there, yeah, which is being rendered and then disrupted.
Yeah. And the visual effect is so strong that you just sometimes have to just stay still and, like, push your face up against a wall just to see, is this really a wall? And, like, sit there for 10 seconds while things stabilize. And the experience is like being extremely drunk. Like, you've ever been so drunk that the world spins faster than your brain can keep up with it, and you just sort of can't see where the stairs are.
I don't know what you're talking about. I certainly never experienced that in my life.
That's exactly what this game feels like. So that's a cool experience. And then lastly, I want to talk about 12 Minutes, which is a game by Luis Antonio, who is an artist on The Witness, but he's also making a game of his own. And it's a top-down adventure game that is like Groundhog Day for just the 12 minutes after you come home from work. And your wife is in the bathroom, and she's prepared dinner, and once she hears you come in, you have a conversation, and she tells you to let her know when you want to have dinner, and there's a bunch of sort of mundane stuff you go through. And then at 8 p.m., I think it is, the doorbell rings. There's someone at the door, and the encounter with that person goes bad more or less no matter what you do, and goes badly enough that you black out, and then we jump back 12 minutes and you've got to do the next 12 minutes again.
I think I've heard of this game.
It's
have you talked about it before on the podcast?
No.
Oh, okay.
I had heard of it too, but I hadn't seen it before. I hadn't sort of seen it running or anything, and I played it for about half an hour, and you can, once you kind of figure out the basics, your character remembers that he's been through it again before. So
right.
You get options to say to your wife, hey, time is repeating and all that stuff, which doesn't work. and you can, well, there's a conversation about that. So it's, I don't know how much more of the game there is. Apparently it's 10 hours long. What I don't know is the whole 10 hours literally in your apartment? Because I try to leave my apartment and you just black out and it starts again. So this scene certainly cannot be any bigger than this. It's just the apartment. And I, like I said, I played it for about half an hour. I didn't get out of that scene. That I can't help but think it must have more scenes to it if it's 10 hours long. I can't imagine it just being this one room for 10 hours. And it's, there's just an enormous amount of depth in what you can do. You can kind of pick up anything and interact with anything. And it's very kind of richly modeled in terms of, reminds me a little bit of Facade, actually, in terms of like just being in this very small situation that's just simulated to a higher degree of fidelity than normal. And there are plenty of rough edges and stuff, but stuff like I sat down at the table. I wanted to like indicate to my wife that I was ready to eat. And so I sat down at the table. And then she didn't arrive, so I just sort of like picked up my spoon and dragged it to my soup bowl, and that caused my guy to eat some soup. And then my wife came in and said, "Hey, why did you eat without me?" And got really upset about it, and then wouldn't talk to me. And she's going to tell you that there's lots of evidence all over the place that she's pregnant, and if you do everything right, then you know, don't upset her, then she will tell you that at dinner. But I had screwed it up too badly, and so she didn't tell me that, even though like I'd found the baby clothes and the pregnancy tests and everything. But there's lots of cool stuff with like...
Fucking soup monster.
Well, like, so I got killed that playthrough after I offended my wife. And then when it rewound 12 minutes, I'm like, okay, this time I'm going to get dinner right. I'll probably still die, but I'm not going to offend my wife at dinner. We're going to sit down in exactly the right order, and I'm going to tell her I'm ready to eat. And I even laid the table for her. Oh, actually, I got both the bowls out, filled them both with soup, put them both on the table. I think I got the spoons out and put them on the table. And then sat down thinking, yes, I've laid the table. I'm doing excellent video gaming. And then my wife thanked me for doing that. But then also, she didn't thank me for laying the table. She said, thanks for putting the bowls out or something. And I was like, And then she went and got drinks of water, which I didn't know I had to do. So I didn't completely lay the table. That'll be my mission when this game comes out. And also, I guess, find out why this guy knocks at your door and... either knocks you out or kills you, depending on how the fight goes. And it does. The thing I like about it is it does, once you realize it's very richly simulated and there's lots of things you can do, there's a phone, and you can dial 911, and you can also look through your wife's text message history, and there are numbers in their text message history as well, which I didn't get to call because I would have needed to write them down and I didn't have pen and paper with me. But stuff like that is quite exciting, where you have this really limited window of opportunity, but there's just, with this very limited set of tools, there's loads of different things you could try. My only criticism was that it's got that thing that every time anyone has been rewound in time and tried to tell someone about it, their reaction is just completely inhuman and bizarre. And this has that too, where when you tell your wife that time is rewinding, you're reliving the same evening over and over again, she says, don't be ridiculous, and then you insist, and then she says, please stop joking, and that's it. And then however many times you say it to her, she says, please stop joking. It's like, I don't think anyone you love and trust and have married and lived with, if they told you that they were experiencing this, at the very least you would think they are hallucinating unless they have brain damage and you take them to the hospital. It would never be like, ah, ha, ha, you're such a kidder,
just joking. Like, not funny anymore, Stephen.
Yeah, almost exactly that. And that's by no means unique to this, but it's kind of more frustrating in a game context, because you know I have the ability to take action about this. And I talked to Luis about this, and he says that he seems confident that will be addressed through some combination of actually letting you ask her to do things that you might want her to do, and also through just writing it, you know, in a way that makes more sense.
Every time travel story like that has to be set in a world where not just people that haven't heard of time travel, but maybe like the notion of time travel is taboo somehow. So making that joke is really offensive. Come on, man, don't joke about that. We don't talk about that since the Time War. Speaking of actually...
Time Wars.
Well, trying to convince people that you've been traveling forwards and backwards through time.
Yes.
That would be an amazing segue if we were to make it to the thing that you and I have both played, Marty.
That would be... Life is Strange.
Episode 5. I was trying to think how you're linking this to Vermintide.
What?
Time travel in Vermintide?
Yeah, it's the fifth and final episode of Life is Strange. The ongoing high school
done now.
Drama / sci-fi yarn.
Hmm. Well, it's over, so yes. Ongoing would not be the...
Oh, well, it has been on. It's been going on a long time. I don't know when the first episode came
February.
Out, but like fucking ages ago now. Yeah, so it's been released in installments.
What's your hot take?
Well, I've kind of been up and down on the series the whole way through. I think it's, as a whole thing, I'm really glad it exists. It's very, very strange.
Product. Game is strange, more like, am I right?
Yes. It's weird. In terms of quality alone, like, it feels like, different teams appraised the same tool set they were given, and some of them really understood it, and some of them really just didn't really know what they were doing. And the episodes are very uneven. Some of the dialogue is terrible. Some of the dialogue is great. The characters are alternately great and terrible as well. The scenarios you're placed in, mechanics. It's very, very, very peculiar experience playing the whole thing. I'm very glad it exists because the highs... I think outweigh the lows on the whole. And it's just a subject that you don't see tackled by games very often, which is...
Time travel.
Well, no, I mean, time travel is, but that's kind of the most normal part of it in a weird way. Because the rest of it is, you know, a kind of coming-of-age story, but of characters you don't usually see in games, which is real women.
Yeah. Talking to women about... Not what a dude character has just done.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But this final episode, well, we can't really spoil anything. That's the tricky thing in discussing it. But I don't know. I think it did come to a very satisfying conclusion for the series as a whole. I think it's set up things earlier on that I did not expect to come back in the way that they did in the final episode. And I felt that was a very neat and clever way of resolving the overall arc of the story. I don't know that it was delivered in a way in which I really felt satisfied by it. Like, it felt like the revelations that bookend the series just suddenly become acknowledged as fact some point between episode 4 and 5 I wasn't really aware of. And on the basis of no obvious additional evidence, I didn't think. But I'm happy. I mean, in retrospect, it all makes sense. It just felt like... You know, the characters were ignorant of whatever this thing is and then suddenly decide...
Yeah, there's one big thing about that, yeah.
It's funny, I've heard the most mixed things about the series in general and then especially the end. I've just heard, like, it's the best thing ever, it's the worst thing ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole of that episode is also uneven because it begins with probably my least favourite scene in the entire series so far. And there's a character in it who I feel is just... terribly cartoonish, even by the standards of that game, which is occasionally kind of larger than life, you know. And that scene is not only kind of mechanically very frustrating and poorly signed, but just the dramatic situation you're put in just doesn't seem... Well, it's credible in that in the way it's set up, but the execution of it, like the mannerisms of the character, just a kind of, I don't know,
I think I'm more forgiving of it, but I agree that it's very cartoonish. I think it's such a tricky thing to get right, I mean, it's not a spoiler to say that there's a villain in the game, but having a character like that have presence is quite difficult. I thought she did actually have presence in that moment, even if it was cartoonish. Like, I found it threatening, even if it wasn't necessarily... Like, I didn't find it laughable, I found that I was quite worried for my character in that situation and so on.
Yeah, yeah, there was a real sense of threat there. I thought the game could become really gross, actually, yeah, at a point.
It does,
and it teeters on the brink of that in a way which I think is actually not exploitative, but actually quite intelligently pinpointed.
I remember you talking about your frustrations in the previous episode about sort of having to memorize the order of some events and recite them that you might not noticed. And it occurs to me that I was planning to play this at some point, because it sounds too interesting. But I would normally play an adventure game with a walkthrough. Would that solve most of the irritations?
It would give too much away.
Yeah.
So the way I do it with like any other adventure games, I play until I get stuck and then I look up.
It's not an adventure game, really. Like, it's a choice-based narrative thing, and you will get through the scenarios. And actually, like, some scenarios have multiple successful routes through them that change subtle other things about the game, but it's more about how you happen to solve a problem rather than... I don't think it's ever hard enough to justify a walkthrough, basically.
Yeah, no, I think you'll bumble through. I mean, you'll be annoyed by it, but you won't ever really be stuck, I don't think. You'll just think, oh, that fucking sucked.
Some things that are slightly... Yeah, it's annoying when it breaks its logic. I think I liked the ending, and I liked it because I think a lot of the time... Well, a lot of the time, two different types of fiction struggle to end. One is choice-based adventure stories, and the other is big, sort of high-concept... science fiction-y television programs.
This is both.
And I think it actually does a better job than most of those things of ending on a definite ending that is nonetheless sort of appropriate to what's come before it. And I think the key to that is that most good endings for stories like this are sort of a way for the either the player in this case or the viewer or whatever to determine what kind of story they thought they were being told. Like what was this story about? And I think it actually ends fairly strongly on that. Hmm. And I kind of, it was interesting. The reason that came up to me is because Pip played it before me and then sort of watched me play the entire thing. Mm. And there were a few moments where we diverged dramatically and we chose completely different endings.
Yes, I chose the same ending as you, I've discovered.
And Pip was like, And then we had a discussion about what we thought the entire series had been about. And the rationale made sense for both of us, why we go with completely different things. Whereas, a lot of games with a big choice-based ending don't really hold to that. There's kind of obviously a right answer or something where it's...
Well, it's interesting you say that because I think the answer... I think I chose our answer knowing it was the wrong thing to do, which is weird. And actually, Pip and Alice have had a conversation about this on Rock, Paper, Shotgun about how they... Because they both chose an ending... the same ending as each other, and they feel that was the right one to do. And the statistics suggest that more people did choose that ending. And increasingly, actually, at the time they wrote that article, I think it was like 55% of people chose their ending. Now, when I played it, I think it was a little while after they did it, it was like 64% of people chose their ending. And I do think that is the kind of correct ending, in that it's the one that kind of the narrative is driving you towards, and there is a kind of... the game has a certain morality, I think, in all of its decisions, and the characters are quite moral. And although you do get the opportunity to be mean slightly occasionally, Max's character is quite fixed, I think.
To a degree.
In comparison to other narrative-based choice games, you know,
she doesn't have like Paragon and Renegade decisions.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, I was going to. I mean, this is. Getting into territory that we have to save for like a spoiler cast, I think, because I want to explain why I disagree with that. Like, I don't think there's a right answer, and I think it's kind of, and I think the entire, to the extent that one thing it does that's kind of interesting is it does what a lot of big stories like this do, and like, not only the world, but the structure of the fiction starts to break down towards the end in the way that it tells you the story, right? It gets, so as someone who watched Lost every week, you know, it started to do that thing where it starts to break its own rules a little bit and kind of fray at the edges. One thing I really like about the finale is it retroactively makes slightly less shit for me what's the series' absolute low point, which is the start of episode 4.
I didn't see anything particularly mind that, but
I hated that for me is the least, I think, the worst it gets. But in terms of being kind of manipulative and stuff. But as it breaks down, it actually allows some breathing room for you to kind of come away from it with a different conclusion, I think. And it depends on some things you prize as a viewer. And I get that's going to be frustrating to listen to if you don't know the story. But what I would say about it is it does hold together. And I think it sustains different readings of something that isn't always brilliantly written, which is kind of interesting. That I still think it's intellectually quite sound, despite being occasionally a bit naive or cartoonish or kind of ham-fisted.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's tricky to talk about rule-breaking when it comes to a game which an impossible thing is possible as its major premise. But it does need a kind of consistency in games where there are obviously there are rules and you need to be able to achieve goals by some kind of strategy. That's the nature of a game. Mm. And if you can't use your intellect to define those rules or the route to the goal, then it feels a very unsatisfying experience. I think one of the central kind of additions it adds to the, obviously, it's about time manipulation. You have certain time powers that you can exploit largely throughout the game, although not very much in the final episode. It adds to that by, at a certain point, allowing you to go into the time of a photograph.
Yeah, that you see. Yeah, but I guess it's not a spoiler.
No, not really. And I found that, although it's quite... it's a clever way to set up certain kind of puzzles later on, I think. It's very, very inconsistent, and it doesn't make any fucking sense, even within the context of being able to manipulate time.
I think, yeah, that was the moment where when they introduced that was when I thought they'd fucked the entire thing, because the classic problem mistake people make is they escalate power too much. Like, if you're talking about superhero fiction, for example, or something like Heroes, which did that exact thing with time.
Into photographs?
No, I mean, they escalated it too much, what that person was capable of, right. Yeah, to the point where they could no longer tell a story.
Yeah.
Because it was Hero in Heroes was the character that broke the series, basically, because it was impossible for them to tell stories as soon as they'd established how powerful he was. Yeah. So they had to, every story at that point had to constantly reconcile, had to find an excuse. And actually, to Life is Strange's credit, it falls into that remarkably little for a story about, you know, if you watch Doctor Who, it's easy to talk about this by talking about more common reference points for this. Doctor Who has just given up on the idea that it will ever make sense and gave up about a long time ago, made a little a running joke out of the wibbly wobbly timey wimey thing to get away with having to have consistent stories, to get away with having to have a story about a time traveler where time travel is actually the key mechanic in the stories. It never is. Whereas Life is Strange, I think, I was really worried that the introduction of like a second power was going to completely break it. Mm. And for the most part, and then I think the final episode actually does quite a lot, even though it's a little bit inconsistent, it does a lot to actually make it important to the story that happened.
Yes. Yeah.
And also allow for that kind of like loosening of the bonds of the fiction that I mentioned that kind of allow you, I think, to come away with a different conclusion. But I can't explain that point anymore without giving these away. So
maybe we should talk about the other game that you and I have been playing.
Can do, yeah.
Vermintide.
That's what you say to a German after they sneeze.
That's what you say after a vermin when they sneeze.
Oh, nice. See what you did there. Shall I explain what Vermintide is?
Please do.
Okay, so Vermintide is... Well, the easy way to explain it is Warhammer Left 4 Dead. But... So I started playing it for the first time today, and one thing that really struck me, because that's what I was willing to go into, was Warhammer Left 4 Dead. It's... You know, you are four characters out of a total roster of five, you and your party of friends, fighting through a city in the Warhammer fantasy world that's kind of overrun by the Skaven, who are these little rat men. During, I think, a recent story arc they ran in the Warhammer tabletop game, which is about the end of the world, which led to them completely rebooting the tabletop game this year. They've thrown all the fiction, they completely changed it all. And it uses the structure of Left 4 Dead to a pretty... fine degree, down to making a big noise in order to progress the mission, but then having to defend for a while, having to like gather things from different parts of the map and carrying them to one place so you can move on to the next part of the level. When somebody dies, if you don't resurrect them, they get taken to a hero cupboard somewhere. There are special Skaven that pin somebody down or so on that require the team to rescue them. So all that stuff is very Left 4 Dead. But it feels like a game from a parallel universe where Left 4 Dead became a genre, which you can imagine it could have done. Because Left 4 Dead is just four people fight a lot of things going somewhere. And there's actually a lot of territory to fiddle with that formula. And I think that's what it is. I think it's actually a mistake to say that it's just Left 4 Dead, because there's so many small things about it that feel very different to me. So one of them is that the Skaven that you're fighting, the enemies themselves, aren't zombies. They are actually... you know, little creatures, and they do things and they sort of move around in a way and announce their presence in a way that makes it feel completely different. So, you know, they are these little skittering little creatures. They talk. They are kind of, and they form into formations and march and chant and that kind of thing. So you can be like attacked by like a rank and file group of Skaven that actually like will pile into a courtyard and look like Warhammer Skaven, and they'll be led by a commander, and killing that commander has an effect and so on. Because they're not, you know, mindless zombies, they have, some of them have, some of the special ones are a little bit more interesting, like the gas flamethrower guy and the minigun guy who kind of lays into his own troops and stuff like that. And it feels like you have to deal with them very differently. But because they feel like more of a matched foe, you're not really survivors. Even though this is apocalyptic scenario where the city's completely overrun, you're the heroes. You're not like, you're saving the city. You're not, you know, the only four people left desperately trying to get to safety. You are, you know, like I was playing as the cool elf, who like this cool Irish elf lady who's got a bow and double daggers or a sword or something. And like there's a witch hunter with a brace of pistols and a fire mage, and the Warhammer fire mages, they dress like braziers because they're so unstable, they might explode any time. So, and the other guy in our party was like the Imperial soldier with a massive Warhammer. It's not the Left 4 Dead thing, which is, the Left 4 Dead thing is the sequence in a zombie movie where the heroes break out of their safe room in the mall and have to fight their way through the crowd of zombies and desperately trying to get to safety, and somebody gets left behind. It's that bit in Lord of the Rings where the Fellowship of the Ring is like running down some stairs fighting some orcs forever. Like that bit in the first Lord of the Rings movie where they fight up the hill, and it does that sort of like cut between like Legolas stabbing someone in an eye and Gimli taking someone's legs off and Aragorn and Boromir doing cool warrior things. It's just that for 20 minutes. And that changes the way it feels. It feels a lot less like you're being kind of like hounded, and much more like you're kind of in this kind of like running banter fight. Because there's banter between the characters and stuff, and it's quite good actually. And it actually reminded me, I used to love Warhammer as a teenager and moved away from it for so long, but it reminded me why I used to really like Warhammer. Because I still think no other fantasy world feels quite like it. As derivative as it is in some ways, and as derivative as Warcraft particularly has been of it, Warcraft is almost like PG-13. Warhammer's still got a bit of an edge to it. It's a bit gross in places, and everything's quite interestingly ugly. Like, it's grotesque. It's
extremely violent, Vermintide, in a way that none of Blizzard's games will ever be.
Yeah. But also the way the characters themselves are designed, like, none of them are just like, none of them are heroic. Like, the Witch Hunter is probably the coolest, on paper, the person you'd expect to be super cool is, a guy in a long coat with a big hat and two pistols and a sword. Is this sort of like snivelly, kind of, he talks a bit like a kind of disapproving Anglican vicar while he's like gunning down crowds of things, and he really disapproves of there's both an elf and a wizard there in a way that's kind of interesting. And the elf seems sort of just on the edge of extreme violence at any point, and the wizard's fucking mad as a box of frogs, and the soldier is actually thick. And so that kind of old sort of 2000 AD comics thing, which is like the other half of Warhammer's heritage, right? Like,
right,
it's,
yeah.
It's 50% Tolkien, 50% 1980s very violent British comic books. It's what if George Dredd was in Lord of the Rings is Warhammer. And it has that feeling to it. And I quite like that. Like,
like the ABC Warriors, actually.
By the same token, I would play Judge Dredd Left 4 Dead. But that would also be Warhammer 40k Left 4 Dead, because, you know.
Exactly. I'll just say, those differences, the things you pinpointed about the lack of oppression and the fact that you're not the survivors under, threat of your life ending. I found Vermintide very, I don't know, it just didn't really grab me. Like, I played it through with Owen, and I don't know, there was something about it. I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was, but I didn't find myself engaged by it. Like, Left 4 Dead for me was an extremely stressful experience, but obviously a very memorable one, and terrifying at points, I think. And this just felt like I was clicking the buttons and the things were falling over. I just never found it grabbing. And I think Owen must have felt the same way, because after a period of time, we just stopped talking to each other over Skype, and it was just, hear his clicking, and that was it. I don't know quite why, because mechanically it's very, very similar. I wonder if the fact that we were playing two melee class characters might have been part of the problem, because they just aren't as dynamic or as interesting as characters which have a range opportunity.
See, I could sort of see that, and I think I know why actually, because as the archer, she can fire incredibly quickly, and so it gives you that kind of Legolas thing of just running down the stairs, putting arrows in heads, which is fun. But then switching to the daggers and something felt like a deliberate pace change, like, you don't really find yourself like, there's no daring do in Left 4 Dead, really, unless something's gone slightly wrong.
Mm.
You know, like, I'd be like, I'd see someone who was in a bit of trouble but on a rooftop below me, and I'd leap down with my double daggers and kill the thing, and that feels cool. I think the thing that would elevate it from what I think is a good game to what would be a actually amazing game.
Are we talking about Vermintide?
Yeah, we're talking about Vermintide. Is if it was just 100% Dark Messiah and Might and Magic's combat system. Because what it doesn't have, like, the sword fighting is not, there's blocking and there's swinging your sword, but that's not based on the direction you're moving or swinging the mouse or anything. It's not very physics-y, to use the real word for that. You can't, like, kick people down the stairs or slide or whatever. Like, and I think a sort of more diverse movement styles for the different characters. So, like, the lighter characters can slide and mantle and stuff like that, and the heavier characters can maybe boot people's faces in and so on. On top of maybe a slightly more finesse, maybe not like a dedicated, like, simulation of sword fighting, but a slightly more finesse-based sword fighting system.
Yeah, it would allow the combat to have a bit more dynamism to it. So.
Well, that dynamism then feeds into the fantasy, which is that you're kind of, you know, these heroes almost showing off your friends. Because the thing I liked about playing it, even with strangers, was that feeling like you're seeing someone else do something really cool as you do something really cool. You're not just grinding through monsters, you're kind of showing off your mates. Like, and that fills back into Lord of the Rings fantasy, right? Because that's what Gimli and Legolas spend those 3 movies doing, right? Like, keeping that kill tally, that kind of thing. Like, it feels like that's kind of what it should be. And the combat system's good, but it's, like, a shade below the really, really great medieval fantasies or fighting kind of combat systems like Dishonored or Dark Messiah.
Yeah, I think the difference is the Left 4 Dead's sense of dread and it's the scenario that you're presented with isn't just, like, you know, dressing to put on a set of mechanics. It actually instructs the way that you approach the game's challenges in that, ideally, because you're so oppressed in Left 4 Dead, you want every situation to be as boring and predictable as possible. Like, that's the ideal, is when things go perfectly right and you don't really need to do anything dramatic and you just get out of it and you're fine. That's perfect. That's actually the desirable outcome. Whereas if you take away that sense of dread and that oppression, I think you're just left with something that's not very exciting. Like, Left 4 Dead wouldn't be an interesting game, I think, if you took away its aesthetic and its the horror vibe it goes for.
You see, I think you can't, like, I think that's what the game showed me is you can change it. It just matters what you change it to. Like, you know, I would also play, I think you can play up the heroic angle. Like, I think when that Avengers game that never got made was some sort of 4-player co-op, wave style thing, as far as I know.
Huh.
And I can see that working. Basically, any film where it's on a tracking shot of multiple characters that are all different fighting through a big wave of anonymous goons, you can use the Left 4 Dead formula for. The entire opening sequence of Age of Ultron could be a game like that, right?
Mm.
Like, and I kind of like to play that game. I think exactly how the combat system works matters.
Yeah.
But I don't think Vermintide is actually too far off. And the other things I really like about it, like, I like that it has that sort of RPG, getting something from the run that changes what you can equip on the character for your next run kind of thing. So, like, I've now got, like, a little mini Gatling pistol for the witch hunter that feels completely different to use. That kind of thing. The fact that the characters themselves feel different to one another, which is admittedly based on the weapon they're holding, but it feels slightly more pronounced than Left 4 Dead, which doesn't really have classes per se, so it's just 3 different, 4 different people. So, yeah, I like it. I think it's, I definitely want to play a lot more of it, and I can see the sequel to it being amazing, basically.
Mm.
Like, it's one of those things where it's like, you've proven this works.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound so down on it. I just, I thought it was fine and very competently made. I just,
Did you feel like you may have played too much of it in one sitting?
No, because I only played one, or maybe it was 2 levels, I can't remember.
Fair enough. Because I played one whole level and I was, like, ready to go again. I really enjoyed it.
Right. Hmm.
But that was, and that was with complete randoms. Like, I wasn't on voice with anybody. Who knows? Game I'm steadily becoming slightly more down on over time. If you want to briefly diverge.
Yes.
Overwatch, unfortunately.
No!
No Overwatch, more like.
Oh, dear.
Well, you see, it's been such a strange arc with that game, because I enjoyed it so much when I first played it and I was really impressed by it, but I sort of conceded to myself to the point, like, you know, I can remember I asked the developer this, like, how, you know it seems a bit vulnerable to, if the players don't want to play it quote unquote right, it could just be not fun, because I think there's a great competitive design there. And then when the last pod was about an hour. We recorded about half an hour after the beta launched for me, so I played like two games, and I had that experience of I got loaded into losing games a couple of times, and it felt a bit like, oh, I've lost all my games so far. But and now I've played it for a week, quite a lot, streamed it on Saturday, and I don't think I've had fun for about 10 games now.
Oh, because you've been losing, or because
not just losing or winning? It's I think it's a competitive design that is really easily broken by people. I think it'll be a really good game if you play it with your mates. And admittedly, I had a lot more fun when I managed to find a party of three or four people to play with. But I think team sizes of six are actually slightly over the threshold that's achievable for most people in terms of what you can reliably kind of like. Everything's more fun with your friends. Five people apparently turned out to be the sort of sweet spot for like just about acceptable. You know, you and a couple of mates have enough of an influence to make it worth going with three. But it's not impossible to get five either, that kind of thing. Six is, I don't know if it's too many or what, but it's I can't imagine myself reliably getting six people around to play it with, which feels like it's how it'll be ideally played. And at the moment, and admittedly it's a, well, put it this way, like I being a closed beta, and as the internet will tell you, quite hard to get into, could go either way. You either get a small set of the most dedicated people, so you could have a lovely community while it's in closed beta that goes to shit when more people get added. Or it can sort of stagnate because there's not enough fresh blood coming into the system. And I think it's somewhere in the middle, because when it started, it seemed reliably like people were quite willing to cooperate and experiment with different classes and so on. And now it's settled into what I can only describe as kind of like the matchmaking funk that I associate with other games. So you load in and people instantly lock Soldier 76, who is a cool soldier guy with gray hair and a machine gun, who's kind of easy to play. He's designed as a newbie character. Reaper, who is a character that was basically just designed by a 15-year-old, as far as anyone can tell. He's a cool man in a black trench coat with two big shotguns and a skull mask. And he looks like what if the Punisher was also Death?
Blizzard.
Yeah. Yeah. I made a joke, maybe in bad taste, that they've done such a good job with having a diverse roster elsewhere that they needed a white man in a black trench coat with a skull t-shirt on, just to kind of like, you know, balance it out. I assume he's white, actually. He's wearing a skull mask. I should have no idea. He's a dick anyway. And Hanzo, who is a cool archer man. And so, and they sort of, it fills up straight away like that, in the same way that any other competitive game does, with like, I'm going to play this guy. Thanks. The support roles are very, very unimpactful to play, and a bit duff. That's one of the game's problems at the moment. But it feels a little bit arbitrary. It feels like the game is, you're so dependent on your teammates. It's configured in a way that makes you dependent on them, that your enjoyment is at the mercy of matchmaking to a degree.
Right.
And that is a problem that, you know, Dota has and Heroes of the Storm has to a degree in any other game like this. But I don't think that a shooter a lot of the time does as well as a more of like a strategic game with the pace of a MOBA, something where it's more obvious what the phases of the game are and what's needed of the team. Heroes of the Storm does a very good job, despite the dickheads in that community. You can never say that they weren't told exactly what they're expected to do, what the criteria for success were at a given point in time. That game's very good at communicating. This is what we're doing now. This is how you win. Oh, you didn't do that. You lost. Whereas Overwatch is much looser. It's a game about momentum along a linear path. It's an attack-defend game. It's like enemy territory. It requires real coordination to break that. And it doesn't really come about. And despite the many, many, many things that game does well, and the many good ideas in it, and the beautiful presentation, and the great character design, I've just stopped enjoying it. And I think I need a break from it. I feel now it's like I've played too much of it. I want to step away and go back when it's had, ironically, right before I go to BlizzCon, where I'm sure they won't be really banging the Overwatch drum at all. I feel like a little bit burned out on it, which is kind of a shame, only a week into the beta. But I don't think I'm an outlier, and I'm certainly not striking out to dislike the game because I loved it when I tried it. But I worry that that's going to be the experience of quite a lot of people, where it's like, I've kind of seen this now. When it feels, when you're on a roll and it's coming together, it feels great. But when you are attempting to get your team together to simply play the game, like actually, you know, not run. I took a screenshot today, I didn't post it, but when you're on the character select screen, it flashes up these context sensitive things to tell you what your team currently needs. And so it'll be like, you don't currently have a healer, you don't currently have a tank, and so on, you know, to encourage people to switch onto those characters. And I found the quintessential one where everything was fine. It was happy about the entire team draft, apart from the fact that it just pops up a message again, too many snipers. And it's got that thing that every shooter has. Mm. It's like all of the kids just want to stand at the back with a sniper rifle. And it's a capture point game. So if you're defending and they can't shoot, you're fucked because they can't stand on the point to contest it. If you're attacking and they can shoot, you're just fucked. And you can't lock a role when a character's locked. Any number of people can pick the same character. They're not exclusively exclusive. So if everyone wants to play Hanzo and Widowmaker, they completely can. And why shouldn't they? They want to have fun. They want to play the game their way. But it's not built so that you can do that and also win. So it's in this weird middle ground. That's actually also interesting psychologically. And this may be something that is more of an interesting design point than a fault with the game. But so like an FPS, like Team Fortress, it allows you to switch between characters and have duplicates of the same character. And of course, Team Fortress originally, they're not characters really. They're just classes, right? It's just a soldier and a spy. And Team Fortress 2 did a lot more to give them personality, but it didn't really rule out the idea that there's more than one of them, right? Like, it doesn't feel completely weird that there's two soldiers or something like that. Whereas Overwatch has that MOBA thing of, like, these are people. They have names. They have backstories. Mm. They have unique looks and abilities. And as such, it feels very strange that there's two of them. And you don't... And it feels like... Something I've heard a lot from my own friends, and you see it on the character select screen, is someone jumps in and goes, oh, hey, we need, you know, it's saying the miraculous thing has happened, and it's saying we need more damage and snipers, because everyone's picked medics and tanks. At which point somebody jumps in, and someone will jump in and play Hanzo, say. But then someone else will pick Hanzo. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, that might work in that scenario. But someone, I want to be unique. Like, it's a really basic thing, but like, I want to feel different. Like, I don't want to just be another Hanzo on this map. Whereas two snipers doesn't feel the same way, weirdly. And so it ends up with this thing of people changing their character constantly because they kind of want to stay different. Super weird, but kind of interesting from a psychological point of view. But yeah, maybe I'll come back from BlizzCon raving about it again.
After they forced you to huff the happy gas.
When I piggyback ride from Chris Metzen or something. I don't know, but... At the moment, I'm a bit like, I'm actually not enjoying this. I'm going to do something else.
Shall we do the questions from questions?
Yes. That's where they come from.
More. I'm drinking.
That did sound like a positive drinking noise there.
It was intended to be.
We're drinking 3-year-old cooperative whiskey.
Indeed.
On the recommendation of...
Being rather uncooperative just then, I'll say.
We've drunk too much.
Yeah.
On the recommendation of a whiskey expert.
Yes, who said that Co-op's cheap blended Scotch whiskey is actually as good as some single malts. Mm-hmm. But
it's not terrible.
I think it's pretty good.
I can no longer tell.
I don't know.
I've tasted some rough whiskey in my time. In my university days, we drank the 6-pound whiskey.
Oh, right.
And that was not like this.
Hugh Lockwood writes in to say, Dear Creighton Crowbar, I was recently watching a local game of soccer/football. During the game, the blue team striker had a shot on goal.
They really called it blue team. I think he's using Rocket League terms.
While the keeper was out of the box, I don't understand any of this stuff. In order to stop the blue team from scoring, the white defender put up his hands. I think he means his hands. And stopped the ball. He was sent off and the blue team were awarded a penalty which they missed.
Shit.
The people I was watching the game with thought that what the white defender did was morally unforgivable cheating. And that his punishment was not enough. I, on the other hand, considered what he did to be an interesting solution to a risk-reward scenario.
All right, Ayn Rand.
I'll stroke my moustache.
He accepted his penalty and stopped a goal because of it. My question is, do you think penalties in sports are deterrents against committing morally inexcusable acts? Or do penalties create interesting risk-reward scenarios that enrich the game? Oh, that is a good question. Good luck with future pods. And by the way, there is a significant difference in audio quality.
Hooray.
Money well spent.
He's saying that because last week we went back to the old setup.
Oh, yeah.
Seems so much better.
So what do you think?
I think that the game should be designed such that if, you know, like fouling and stuff is a behavior they actually want to never happen, then the penalty should be so severe that you would never do it. It would never be in your interest to do it. And if the game is structured so that it is sometimes in your interest to do it, that's the game's fault and not the player's fault. And you should...
Yeah, I don't know. In football, it's an interesting one because actually, I mean...
If you foul, then you just get shot in the head on the pitch. Your corpse is just left there for the rest of the game. No one would do it.
No. I think a handball is kind of on the line about whether it's a risk-reward scenario. I think, but the problem is that football has a problem with other people abusing the rules in the way that they fake injury all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just pathetic and tedious and not an interesting way of manipulating those rules. I don't know how you can legislate against one but not the other, really.
Yeah, the injury one's tough because there's not an easy way to verify whether an injury is genuine or fake, and so that's why faking is so bad.
Keep kicking them. They get up, it's fine.
How do you... All right, so if you kick them and they get up, then they're fine.
It's a fair complete. It's not one anyone want to enter into.
But also, if you keep them kicking them, they do get legitimately injured then as well. So
I guess that could work. Like, if they're acting injured, you have to legitimately injure them. So, either way, it doesn't really matter now if they're faking.
Perfect.
Because now they're injured.
I don't think it is a fair risk-reward system, really, because unlike video games, the vast majority of sports require some kind of human referee to determine whether the rules are being adhered to. Because actually, in that case, it's not, even though obviously, like, football is not a designed game. Like, most traditional sports are not designed in the way that games are designed. There's not a designer there who's responsible for closing off loopholes necessarily. This might sound a bit wanky, but football is kind of like agreed upon every time it's played. Like, an instance of football occurs, and it only occurs because all the players participate on in it at a certain level. Like, the momentary existence of sport exists because of a buy-in from everybody who agrees to play by certain rules in a certain way. Because otherwise, it's just, you know, physics. We sort of said this in the break, but like, if it was totally flexible what you're allowed to get away with, because you were sort of, in doing so, you're rebelling against some sort of external authority that's placing the rules upon you.
It'd be Blood Bowl, then.
It would just be a fight.
I don't know anything about football, but I know there are associations to do with football. Can they change the rules of football? Can they
They act as governing bodies for it, basically. Right. They're sort of the macro scale. But when we're talking about a game or football, whether it's the World Cup final or pub football, still, really, it just comes down to humans enforcing rules in the moment. And therefore, the level at which people are engaged matters. If you establish that actually it's okay to subvert the rules as long as, A, you get away with it, or, you know what I mean, whatever, then it becomes a race to the bottom for everybody else. Mm. The most successful people are the people who are willing to subvert the system the most. Whereas if there is an agreed-upon level of basic participation, then the sport can actually occur without kind of immediately devolving. It is in that way a bit like society. Like, if you said it's actually okay to do some killing and murder and stealing, as long as you don't get away with it, and like the most people don't mind, then things quickly get out of hand.
That's why we have tax avoidance, Chris.
It is, yeah, because it's like, well, no, it's not hurting anyone and being clever. I mean, that's the reason I made a joke about Ayn Rand when he pointed that out, and I'm sure that's not where he's coming from, but it trends towards that line of thought where it's like, I can, so I should, or I can, so I'm right to, which is a very different thing.
I think, you know, there is something to be said for the gentlemanly aspect of sport as it was performed in the 19th century.
Outdated to kind of like, I think when he sort of says that, you know, the rules are there to provide, like, that somehow touching the ball with your hands becomes immoral in the case of
football, the only reason I think the handball is a difficult thing, because obviously handballs happen accidentally and it's difficult to tell whether they are or not.
Sure, but then they need to be a sort of, I think, you know, you have to respect the referee in that case.
Yeah.
Just sort of,
but also, it's still not a risk-reward scenario in that, because the only time a risk-reward scenario rears its head is if it's intentional.
Yeah, but it's not like, if it was a risk-reward scenario, the game would become about finding more and more creative ways to use your hands without anyone noticing, to the extent where you'd be like, they'd realise off. That man's upside down. He's been running around his hands this entire time, using his advantageous hands to pick up. I don't know.
Yeah.
Basically, I
suppose, you know, you could say that cheating does add an extra element to a game, but I it depends what aspects of the game you're there to appreciate and valorise.
I think all players need to understand that.
If you perform an illegal action and take a penalty for it, then it's not cheating. Cheating is when you, like, you do something that's outside of the rules of the game and...
But you are being punished for it. I mean, that's the purpose for it. It's not that you are.
Yeah, but if it was like, if you had, to me, cheating's like, oh, you're not playing the game. If someone's cheating at cards, you don't sort of give them a, oh, that means you dock 6 points. If you dock 6 points, then that means that's part of the game rules.
Yeah, but in that sense, like, imagine, for example, in football, right? Teams are allowed to hire basically as many players as they want, for how much money they want. Imagine if it was okay. Imagine if it wasn't considered cheating to deliberately break the rules as long as you took the penalty for it. In that case, it would be very advantageous for the richest teams to systematically tackle horribly people on poorer teams, because they might get horrible red cards and like season bans for their players, but they can afford to replace those players. The weaker teams can't afford to replace all the shins they're getting broken.
Yeah,
going up against the team.
I still see that as a game design problem. I think they
what shins?
The football associations, whoever they are, I should know the name. Is it FIFA?
It's FIFA. Right.
Okay, so FIFA should redesign the game so that if you do something that egregious, then your whole team is banned forever. It's just the whole thing.
But you give FIFA $30 million, and I mean this is what we're talking about.
Exactly, which is a problem with game design. Like the game design process is corrupt.
Well, exactly, but the problem is that FIFA itself has become a kind of game.
But I don't know how you'd have a punishment for, say, doing a handball, which was sufficiently severe enough to be a deterrent without it just disrupting the enjoyment of the game for everybody watching it. Like, I mean, you couldn't just kill the player. You couldn't just stop the game and say, it's over now, you've ruined it. Because that would be a rubbish experience.
If it was accidental, you mean?
No, if it was intentional. I mean, like you're saying...
Well, someone... It's against the rules to bring a gun on pitch and shoot someone. If they did that, they would call the game off, right? They wouldn't carry on. There's no penalty.
I meant that as being a punishment for doing a handball when you kill.
Yeah, sorry, that was an unrelated shooting incident. I just brought it into this.
Man, this is what I'm trying to say is like game.
It's already
there are already things you can do in a football match that would cause the game to be called off. And the reason they're so against the rules that the whole game would be cancelled.
They're not against
your team
they're not in football's rules. They're in society's
exactly.
rules.
Exactly. They are. It's you don't even need a rule against shooting people because it's assumed that that's wrong. And so there are already things like that. And so if you decide that this thing that you're doing is so disruptive that there's no situation in which it should ever be incentivized, then it should have the same penalty. It should be. It's absolutely unacceptable. Your whole team is banned. To the point where no one would ever do it intentionally.
I don't think you can do that with something like handball.
I agree, yeah. If there's doubt about whether it's intentional or not, then that's where it gets tricky.
I just think it's harder to apply game design problem logic to this because you're dealing with a sport that's been jury-rigged around how human bodies work and how physics works.
Yeah.
And accidents are always going to occur. If in that scenario where a handball was so severe that you had to like send the players off or cancel the match, you would just have players without hands. It would be the only way to have that sport work. It would. You know what I mean? It would be like the only way, like, it would have to be a game that took place between people who do not have hands. Or else the risk of it happening would be too great. Like, basically the system has to be flexible in a way that computer games traditionally are not flexible in order to account for the slight breaking the rules. But that does not mean that the rules are just there to be broken whenever. In my opinion.
What an opinion it was. A person on the internet writes, "Good day, Creighton Crow bird is the word. Sorry."
Shit.
I've heard of Portal Still Alive being played at funerals before, which made me wonder. What other...
That seems like a bit of an own goal, really.
What other moments make for strange bedfellows with the video game music? Super Hexagon soundtrack in the bedroom, perhaps? Or maybe you'd rather make your favourite dump on the Citadel by listening to Mass Effect's Music on the Throne. We were playing the game, board game Pandemic the other night. I have a prolifically terrible record of selecting music to go with it. Cause I came selecting stuff which is just too aggressively depressing to listen to. Like the Under the Skin soundtrack, which I thought would be a kind of atmospheric, you know, it's a Pandemic's a game about global plague, but Under the Skin is just a level of existential terror too great for that, really. then I followed that by selecting the It Follows soundtrack, which was also really, really horrible.
Which you thought sounded a bit like Fez music in some ways, and then realised that it is by Disaster Piece who did the music for Fez.
Yeah, I didn't realise that at the time. But,
you know what we should use next time is Defcon soundtrack.
Oh, yeah! Well, actually, the soundtrack that you picked, which was the...
Assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah, it was actually really, really good for it.
Yeah,
it was a great soundtrack. Very melancholy. I don't have any other more insightful answer to that question.
No, neither do I, really. Although... I guess I played a lot of the X-Wing miniatures game the other night while listening to all of the Star Wars original trilogy soundtracks with Tom, and got irritatingly into it. So, do you know, in that kind of way, like, this isn't going to work. I'm pushing plastic X-Wings around a table. I'm here now. I'm inside.
He also follows this up with a little poem he wrote to the Guy Fawkes rhyme, which relates to Graham's anecdotes from Prison Architect. And he says, "Remember, remember, the prison gang member punching toilets as he plots. I know of no reason why his blind escape treason should ever be forgot." It's rather good.
That's pretty good.
It's also, yeah, fits nicely with the traditional one.
Pop meter.
More poems about our anecdotes, please.
Tim O'Ryan is one of about 50 fucking billion people who wrote in with facts about the Caduceus slash the, well, not slash, actually, the Rod of Asclepius, which are alternately used, one of which is incorrect, for the symbol for medicine in the United States. Apparently, the Caduceus is an incorrect usage. Whereas the Rod of Asclepius is.
Are these symbols that look different?
They look similar. I mean, the Caduceus is the twin snakes wrapped around a rod. With wings.
A fearsome rog.
Opening your rog in the living room.
And the Rod of Asclepius, I think, is just a single snake slash serpent wrapped around a stick with no wings. Asclepius was a Greek god associated with medicine healing, says Tim O'Ryan. But he also adds this, which some of the other people writing about this did not.
Congratulations, Tim. So congratulations. You've won Explain Caduceus 2015.
He also writes that the one theory about the origins of the Rod of Asclepius is that it represents a traditional treatment for the guinea worm.
You've got to treat the that guinea worm. What's a guinea worm?
A guinea
you
worm.
You stab yourself and then wrap yourself into snakes.
He goes on to explain exactly what a guinea worm is. He says, a guinea worm is a parasitic worm that infects humans via drinking water. It can grow up to 100 centimetres inside the body, at which point it emerges through the victim's skin, usually on the foot. The worm can be then extracted by wrapping it around a stick, then turning the stick to pull the worm out of the body.
Oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
That does make perfect.
I've heard of that thing as well. Like I think it's still a problem today, in third world countries,
Africa,
and it's fucking horrific.
Gross.
So there you go.
So it's not a snake, it's a worm.
Yeah. Disgusting.
Wow, that should have been that character's ultimate ability in Overwatch. Slowly extract a worm. Is that where the phrase "the worm turns" comes from?
I don't know, actually. Where does that come from?
Please
don't write in. We'll look it up on Google.
Next week, Worm Turns 2015. Who will have the bonus fact necessary to clinch it?
Pasco, who also wrote in about the Rod of Asclepius slash the Caduceus, he says at the end of this email, the mice universes you talked about last week. I assume this makes sense to one of you.
This Tom Senior hadn't played a video game, so he just told us about an interesting article he read.
Okay. About mice, which I assume is related to horrific social experiments.
Yes. So I don't want to go through it again, but it's amazing. You should read about Mouse Universe 25.
Okay.
I did read about it from the show notes.
It's good. It's basically Mad Max with mice.
Wow. Okay. Well, apparently these experiments were a major inspiration for the similarly social experimental vaults from the Fallout games.
Huh. Makes sense.
To which he adds a question. If you were to be trapped in a vault during a prolonged nuclear winter, what social experiment would you like to have run on you? Love the Paul. Love the Paul. Love the show. Paul.
Well, we love the Paul.
But
imagine
also,
if Paul signed all his emails. Love the Paul. Remember, kids, love the Paul.
Well, we do.
My dad's called Paul.
I thought he was... yes, okay. Sorry.
If I was to be trapped in a vault in a social experiment, I would like I like to be selected to be part of a vault experiment with only people who play Dota but are like half as good at Dota as I am. So that rather than having to exist in the eternal middle of a massive matchmaking pool, I exist solely quite a substantial distance at the top of a very small matchmaking pool, and therefore become esports man in a way that I would never aspire to be in real life.
In real life, where you run an esports site.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Caduceus, 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 Asclepius, Caduceus, Asclepius. Amy writes in to say something which isn't about a rod. Dear CNC Podcast Factory, I've been thinking a lot recently about the way some games do or don't incorporate the mechanics into the plot or lore of the game world. Often a mechanic is better left unjustified, as having as opposed to having an in-universe reason for it. For example, your character respawning after they die would be a greater distraction if they had a reason for it than just having them respawn because of the video game. However, I find a well-used justification can really add to coherency and immersion within a game story. For example, Heather in Silent Hill 3 being dragged off screen after she's killed hints that she is being resurrected in the plot rather than just restarting from the last save point. What are some of your favourite examples of in-universe explanations for game mechanics, or alternatively, examples where an attempt at justifying a mechanic ended up being a bigger distraction than just not mentioning it at all? Cheers, Amy.
I think respawning is a really interesting type of this, because there are, I think, almost every game where you respawn makes some attempt to explain it. Like, games where you restart, saving is almost never explained. It's always just, oh, the player has a magic ability to go back in time and redo his mistakes. But when your character dies, they respawn in the world, but the world stays the same.
Oh,
then
right,
everyone feels like, oh shit, we've got to have an explanation for that. So GTA has one, which is every time you die, you just respawn in the hospital. Apparently, you're just very badly injured, despite Bioshock the fact that you crashed a helicopter into a tank and the rest of it. And also, like, apparently, all of those crimes that you committed were not an issue. They just healed you up, and you're on your way. And yeah, System Shock, I don't know about System Shock 1, but System Shock 2 had quantum reconstructors that were never super convincing. You had to pay 5 nanites to store your quantum, like, it was something like quantum entanglement paired or something, and then that meant if you died, you'd respawn there. And that was respawning rather than restarting. And then Bioshock did it and also tied it to the plot, because the reason you respawn in Bioshock, spoilers for Bioshock if you haven't completed it yet.
Skip ahead 30 seconds.
Yep. Maybe a couple of minutes. The reason you respawn is that you are Andrew Ryan's son, and the whole of Rapture is coded to his genetic key, and that means that, like, he is invincible and so are you, although he dies.
Golf clubs send it really haywire. I can't deal with them.
There is something to do with the genetic key at that moment that may explain that. And but then there's something weird where you hand over the genetic key to Fontaine, but he doesn't respawn, which is strange.
He also turns into a giant statue of Atlas.
Yeah. Many things went wrong from that point onwards. And you can read my version of what should have happened on my blog, mentadark.com. But that was one where, like, the fact that they tried to tie it into the fiction meant that it kind of broke down when that part of the fiction also broke down. And also, oh God, they really fucked this up. Not to hammer on an ending that's already not well liked, but they also just tell you, like, so after you give the genetic key to Fontaine and he converts it all to work for him, respawn chambers still work for you for the next couple of levels, and then when you fight him, they are turned off, and it just comes up with, like, an in-game dialogue box saying, from now on, you can't respawn, with no explanation
right.
at all.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, they set it up to be a thing that was explained in world, and then betrayed, and then screwed up the logic of that, and then after they screwed up the logic of that, also betrayed it anyway, in a really clunky dialogue box.
I thought Infinite did that kind of better, actually.
Elizabeth kind of rescues you. Right?
Well, no, because what happens is...
Oh, yeah.
But that, again, minor spoilers for Infinite, because this is not necessarily that far into the game. But what happens in Infinite is you see yourself leaving your office again briefly, and your office is sort of the beginning point of that story. You find out exactly what Booker was leaving his office to do at the end of the game. But essentially what it sort of implies in shorthand is that you've then done the entire game up to that point again. But this is the timeline where that thing that just kills you didn't happen.
Right.
And that's a really nice, so it's sort of, you know, obviously it doesn't make you play the entire thing again, but it's sort of like, and what if that didn't happen, because it's all about what if that didn't happen. On the subject of respawning specifically, I'd say that console thing, but Destiny is the only game I've played that has 100% an explanation for this that is completely internally consistent and still allows for drama, because that game begins with you being respawned. Because your ghost, the little robot that follows you around that was formerly Peter Dinklage and is now Nolan North, resurrects you at the beginning of the game. And that's what ghosts do. They attach to a particular person and then they become that person's... they do a lot of things for them, including open doors, scan things, and be your inventory. But their job is to resurrect you if you die. And so everything from when a character dies, they disintegrate, but their ghost stays behind. And that's if you're reviving another player, you're always going to their ghost and giving them your character's energy so that the ghost can revive the person that they're attached to. So even reviving each other is kind of explained.
Hmm.
And then the drama is like whenever it characters, you know, story characters can die, but it requires their ghost to be destroyed first, which just, it sort of can't happen to the player. Your ghost is immaterial and in your backpack, presumably, for the game. Which, I mean, it is a bit hand-wavy if something completely catastrophic happens to you, but the ghosts are supposed to be incredibly, almost indestructible. So it becomes a big deal when a player character type, a guardian, dies in Destiny, because it means that something terrible has happened to their ghost, and then the person has been killed.
I remember. So
it sort of holds together quite well.
I remember when Edge magazine said, in a somewhat complimentary way, that my explanations for gunpoint mechanics were hand-wavy. Because the crosslink is like, it's meant to be like a mobile phone app that just... buildings in the future are all the actual physical wires connect everything to everything, and it's just all done in software as to what things are linked up to what things. And yeah, there's like an email about that, and they sort of very vaguely suggest that this is possible, and also you can jump like 300 feet and that's fine because of hydraulics.
I've actually spoken a little bit about this before, I think, but again, an example of a series that I appreciate for attempting to tie mechanics to narrative is Dragon Age and its magic system, which is kind of interesting. Like, you read about it, it kind of acknowledges some of the things about how magic tends to work in games. And it tries something with the fact that it sort of explains, it's one of the only games I can think of that explains what a mana potion is. Like, why it should be that something you drink would actually restore mana, and what mana is. Because that's an abstraction. You know, the games need an energy mitigation system, so you can't choose your abilities all the time. Mana in Dragon Age represents your character's kind of connection to magic, but that's mitigated by a substance called lyrium, which your character imbibes as part of a potion. But as part of that story, it's supposed to be incredibly addictive and debilitating, which almost works as a kind of game mechanic thing, because you are constantly chugging them. But over time they sort of developed that kind of addiction thing, and lyrium addiction is a thing in the story, and it affects other characters quite badly, and it's something that your player character is always kind of kept completely immune from. And similarly with, like, if you play an elf or someone who's like an underclass in that game, you're not really affected by it. And I wrote an article about this once, about the making of that, but as part of my interview with the BioWare writers teams, they said that they felt like, as far as they could go to kind of make traditional game fantasy things have more interesting consequences, or kind of build systems around them that make them more interesting, which also applies to, like, the persecution of magic and stuff like that, where they've sort of taken a game thing, magic, and said, what would the society be like that built around this, and what kind of strictures would it place on itself, rather than it just being like, you know, a wizard in every tower kind of thing. But they've always felt that they have to keep the player from that, which is sort of, I think, where they have to keep the player from being affected by the same things that they build around to explain the game mechanics normally, because ultimately they've got to stay game mechanics, and you can't let the story kind of wade in the other direction in order to make them more interesting. So, you know, picking a mage in Dragon Age shouldn't mean you have a harder game because people want to arrest you constantly. But I think that's what I think is a really interesting idea, and something I think a lot of people dream about games getting completely right, but that is so hard because it's such a very specific balance that to make it interesting, you've got to make it have stakes, and for it to have stakes, it can no longer fully be a game mechanic.
Yeah.
And then it kind of feeds back on itself.
Yeah. All of Miyazaki's games have very interesting respawning mechanics that are totally incorporated into the fiction. But I've talked about that quite a lot.
Yeah.
In other forms. So I shall not talk about it now.
Link in the show notes to the Dark Souls series, though.
In fact, I shall not talk anymore because this is the end of the podcast. And those are all the questions we had time for. If you want to send us more questions, you can do so at questions@creightonandcrowbar.com. Or you can tweet us at Creighton and Crowbar. Or you can go to our forums and write questions there, should you so wish, which is at creightonandcrowbar.com/forums. There's also now a chat channel, which seems to be the preferred means of our community to congregate, the link for which can be found on the sidebar of our website, which is obviously also at creightonandcrowbar.com. Not at creightonandcrowbar.com, just creightonandcrowbar.com.
Yeah, and the sidebar is just a bar on the side. You don't have to go type like /sidebar or anything.
No.
That'd be confusing.
We also have a Patreon.
We do, yes. You can
donate to us, which is patreon.com/creightonandcrowbar. And is that it?
I think that's it.
Oh, you can follow us individually.
Yes!
I'm at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-E-C-T.
I'm C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
I'm at Marsh Davis, that's D-A-V-I-E-S.
Oh, last week they told me off on Discord for phoning that bit in, and I think I've just phoned it in again. I wasn't ready. I'm really sorry. Can I fix my microphone?
Yes. You're slowly getting...
I'm melting! My hot tanks, they're too hot!